Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there. Do we know whether social media is bad for kids? Is the World Central Kitchen tragedy an inflection point in the Gaza war? And does it make any sense for Richard Dawkins to be a so-called cultural Christian? We'll discuss all this and more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry, and I'm joined as always, or at least some of the time, by Jackie B, Jack Butler, Noah Rothman, and the notorious MBD, Michael Brennan Doherty. You are, of course, listening to a National U podcast. Our sponsor of this episode is Made In Cookware. More about them in due course. If for some reason you're not already following us on a streaming service, by the way, you can find us everywhere from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So MBD, Jonathan Haidt, has been on the case for a while, arguing that social media is responsible for this really extraordinary downdraft in mental well-being among young people, especially girls. That's showing up in the data and the surveys. And he has a new book out called The Anxious Generation. 60 Minutes did a segment on it. He's done a lot of podcasts. It's engendered a lot of commentary, including a very critical review. And I believe it was the journal Nature saying, look, you know, he's got to understand the difference between correlation and causation. And just what he's established is correlation. What do you make of it?
Yeah. I've been very interested in this debate for a long time. And I have to say, although I'm open to Haidt's skeptics in that I do think that there's been a rise in diagnosis of mental health issues.
And maybe self-reporting.
I think it's the ubiquity of school counseling and referring children to more counseling, and then the counselors expose them to therapists. And there's more incentive for diagnosis than ever before, because it can come with all sorts of additional state-funded benefits for children and services. So I think that there's, you know, but that's basically the only factor. Which what I've read from Chait's book, or from Haidt's book already, and then what I've listen to him engage in various podcasts on this, preparing for the show. I mean, the sheer tonnage of studies that he brings to bear to make this point that in 2012, in several countries, you see the same exact effect on young people, particularly young girls, as social media becomes ubiquitous. And I just think he connects it to a larger story about the disappearance of a childhood based around play.
That's like the other side of his argument, right? That tends to get neglected. He's not saying it's social media alone. It's the way that childhood has been rewired, as he puts it.
It's been
interaction and freedom.
This unhealthy activity has displaced a very healthy and necessary, developmentally necessary activity. And he writes about this with such a fluidity and a fluency in the data, of which there's tons. And it also fits, I think, with a lot of adult experience of cell phones as demoralizing and depressing to interact with over an extended period of time. I think we all have felt that when we give too much attention to this little black screen in our pocket, we're missing out on not just the people around us, but like literally even sunshine and fresh air, which we need to stay mentally healthy. So I think height has the better of the argument. I think there's just a ton of, there's a kind of built-in skepticism of arguments like this, because people say, oh, well, you know, people complained about the television before. In fact, I think the complaints about the television were mostly vindicated over time.
Yeah, they're right.
that television did dumb us down significantly as a society. That's why we have, like, you know, Bill Clinton counts as a great statesman in the television age, whereas, and he can't hold a candle to Winston Churchill.
Yeah, it's so, when I wrote this book about Lincoln and read a lot about Lincoln, it's so touching how, I believe it was the Cooper Union speech, you know, Lincoln's speech was like 2 hours, right? And then they had like a panel commenting on the speech. And I don't know, they went on for 4 hours, and then everyone wanted to stay and hear more, not just because they were interested, you know, in the politics and the intellectual arguments, because it was entertainment, right?
Yeah. I was reading through some of the Lincoln Douglas debates a few weeks ago, and some of the comments that when Lincoln or Douglas is retorting, is saying something like, "Thank you for your 3-hour remarks. I now wish to respond with my own 3-hour remarks." I'm just like, wow.
Well, and if you look at, like, you know, at like a Mr. Beast video, right? Like the most popular YouTube creator today, basically, like, he will condense what would have been like a season's worth of network television game show into a 15-minute video that has a pace to it that makes anyone watching it feel like they've just swallowed a bottle of Adderall. Like, I've come up with friends with a term for this, like Adderall brain content on social media that you see through TikTok or YouTube or Instagram now. You know, the stuff that lasts for, you know, 5 seconds to 15 minutes that is really, you know, like intellectually empty calories.
Yeah. Well, and I just feel it, you know, I'm not a kid, you know, it's not, screen time's not cutting into my free play, but, you know, I do try to be a conscientious reader, and I can just feel the phone limiting my ability to concentrate, you know, and when I read at night, you know, I'll just take the phone and put it face down in another room, you know, and I'll still feel drawn to go look, you know, so it takes a real effort. But, you know, if I were a 15-year-old girl, I might not be so disciplined about it. But Jack, so one of the arguments Haight makes against his critics is, you know, as MBD points out, he says, look, this is not, it's not just in the United States. We're observing this trend of declining mental health or reported mental health all around the developed world. And what's the other explanation for it? And I think he's extremely effective in knocking down the other, you know, is it the financial crisis? Well, why would the real onset of this be 4 years after the financial crisis? Is it September 11th? Well, the timing doesn't work for that. Wars in the Middle East, that doesn't work either, on and on.
Yes, I also find his explanation persuasive. And I think that you can say, perhaps, if you apply strict analytical lenses to some of the arguments he makes, you might not be able to, you might be able to keep him from making the leap from correlation to causation in a strict statistical sense. But I think to limit your, at least at this point, I suspect that eventually that leap will be made by any lens that you can apply to it. But even if you can't right now, I think there's something deeply intuitive about what he's saying, even especially when you marry it to all of the correlative data that he can marshal. And it's intuitive to me when I think about my own childhood. I'm in something of a unique place in that I am just old enough to have had perhaps the last vestiges of the kind of childhood that he argues is now vanishing. I was let loose for endless summer days. I romped around in the creek. My parents would ring a bell to summon me for dinner.
You had a creek right there. That's one of the marvels of childhood, is having a creek nearby.
Oh, it was great. We did a lot of stuff in the creek. Some things that would probably horrify my parents to have known I was up to, just the danger and whatnot and the silliness. But it was great. And the unstructured play was essential to forming, just exploring and growing as a child. And the sense I get from children who are growing up now is that they don't have that. And more important, perhaps, is that what the substitute they're getting is just, they're being funneled into unreality. Or so either the reality that they have is structured, or they're being forced into a fake substitute that will never measure up to the real thing. And I find it extremely persuasive that that is having negative effects on childhood development. I mean, just think of the way there's actually, I only read the long essay adaptation probably the introduction or first chapter of his book that appeared in The Atlantic. But so I don't know if in the whole book he makes this argument, but there's probably a case to be made for a connection between the way that children are now growing up and the things that they now demand of their in their institutions, in the sense that they've become accustomed to having all this mediation and arbitration imposed upon them in their upbringings, in their day-to-day lives. And now when they try to navigate reality, they are constantly searching for third parties and external authorities to refer to and to reference and to guide them in a way that I think has helped to deform our politics as well. So this is not something that is simply limited to something as terrible as just the mental health of young people. It's also spilling out into our politics as a whole, or at least I think there's a good case that it is. So that this brings up the natural question of what to do about it. And I am not really sure. I don't know. There are government actions that probably can be taken, but a lot of it is going to have to come down to shifting cultural norms. And it's very hard to shift cultural norms when you have just the sheer march and progress of technology all militating in the other direction. So I'm in favor of all the, for example, the schools that are turning into no phone areas. My high school was like this, my grade school, this was a non-factor. My high school, it mattered less for my high school because my phone couldn't really do anything in 2007 to 2011. It was very primitive. You were almost afraid of accessing the internet on it because there was like this fear that it would cause a giant addition to the phone bill in the family. So I just avoided it at all costs. So I'm grateful that I had those strictures on my life just by accident of birth. But to impose things like that now in institutions where it's feasible seems like it's necessary. What else to do? I don't know. But I'm open to suggestions and ideas because it seems like something needs to be done to address this problem. And
I'm an age restriction guy. We had a big argument about this with Charlie a couple weeks ago. Noah, what do you make of it?
So I haven't fully read Haidt's latest book. It's as an extension of his book with Greg Lukianoff, The Coddling of the American Mind. It seems to dovetail with their thesis. I'm intuitively accepting of the premise that phones have behavior altering effects on young people, and certainly that the digital environment is distorting in ways that, as he said, rewire childhood, functionally make create psychological incentives and behavioral changes in people who would otherwise be socializing with their fellow young people and learning pathways to have a functional social relationship with another human being that are deprived on social media because it's such a performative platform. I'm leery of the prospect that you can launder techno-pessimism into this argument, which I don't think is necessarily Haidt's argument. What his argument seems to be, to me, to be, is one for effectively just social hygiene. And hygiene is a learned process. You don't grow up intuitively knowing that you have to brush your teeth every day. It's taught and it's reinforced. And this is something that I don't think is especially difficult for us as a society to encourage. When I was, my kids were very young, we learned pretty early on that exposing young children to, for example, YouTube, the algorithmic features on YouTube, in which creators just use digital platforms to stimulate young people and children's minds in ways that are very addictive, obviously addictive, and mood altering. We found that pretty quickly and reversed our decision to just park the baby in front of YouTube pretty much right away. And over the pandemic, you saw the effects of extended screen time on children. I think everybody did. And it was something of a wake-up call. The notion that this is all monocausal, which is the big hit on Haidt, doesn't seem to me to be either a fair reading of his analysis or somebody who's very much in the same field and has a piece in the magazine this month, Jane Twenge. And she's not a monocausal person either. When she was researching, for example, when I was researching her work for my last book, she was diving into the decline of sexual encounters among young people and attributing it to a variety of factors. The financial collapse and phones are one of them, and all, it all combines. But one of the biggest problems in that sense was the strictures that were increasingly imposed on young people by institutions amid a moral panic around the notion that rape and sexual assault are so profoundly prevalent and unseen that a variety of new social conventions need to be established in order to deter and discourage that sort of behavior. And the strictures, as she identified in her research, were a product of the virtual world, not the other way around. It wasn't the strictures that begat the virtual interactions that young people currently languish in. It was the alternate reality that was being fostered by a situation in which young people were bombarded daily by the prospect of threat that wasn't real. That was just a manufactured product of the world that they were steeping themselves in. And that corresponds really closely with John Haidt's research, that there's an illusory world that's being erected on social media, and it's giving young people an inaccurate assessment of what their environment is really like and what the threat really is, threat level is for them. So I think that the ultimate thesis here that Haidt's retailing is pretty airtight. His critics certainly haven't hit any marks, with the exception, we were talking earlier about Tyler Cowen's interview with John Haidt before we started recording, and it's a good interview, you should check it out. And the only critique that I think that is sound in that one is the notion that the worst possible scenario here is only possible in a straight line trajectory. And the straight line trajectory doesn't make sense to me. And I think that Haidt would agree, if you really pressed him on it, that if this unsustainable situation presents itself as such a profound menace to social health and civic health, that it will be corrected. And we're beginning to see the outlines of what that correction looks like. And I don't think it requires vast amounts of public sector intervention in private life. I think it is merely a function of us understanding and agreeing that a certain amount of hygiene and regulation of your access to these products is just a basic part of life and should be. I don't think that's necessarily hard to accept or hard to implement.
That's a segue to the extra question to you. First, MBD, we have reached peak social media. Yes or no?
No. And I'll just define my terms this way. I think social media is the most effective way for companies, for corporations to gather intelligence about their customers, us. And so I think there's a tremendous incentive for people to keep incentivizing us to spend time on them on social media.
Jack?
No, I think true reckoning with what we're doing with ourselves is probably going to come in the next generation.
No.
Probably not, but I think the seeds of its decline, if not downfall, have been sown. The market mechanism here, I think, will take over pretty soon, because the market model for social media is deeply flawed. It's not a profitable enterprise. And beyond that, if there are obvious health risks associated with psychological and perhaps even physiological, then yes, I think that we will have a big national conversation about how to limit its effects on young people.
I'm going to say peak social media is within sight. I think people realize the harms. I think a lot of parents intuitively know the harms, or it's not a good thing compared to other things that their kids can be doing. But as Haight often points out, there's an enormous collective action problem. But I think we're starting to see a sea change on this matter. With that, let's go to our sponsor of this episode. If you're considering the pros and cons of different cookware brands, you should know that Made In has more of the pros. Pros like Tom Colicchio, Nancy Silverton, Brooke Williamson, and many other professional chefs who all trust their cooking to Made In cookware. Fact is, Made In has a long-standing relationship with professional chefs. The company evolved from a 100-year-old kitchen supply business and works with multi-generational makers to craft each piece. They make exactly what demanding chefs are looking for, including a wide selection of curated products from carbon steel to stainless clad, plus plateware, glassware, and more. But perhaps the biggest pro is that Made In is sold online and delivered to your door, all for a fraction of the price of other top brands. If you want to take your cooking to the next level, invest in Made In cookware. Once you try it, you'll be pro Made In too, just the way I am. We have some Made In frying pans here in the Lowry kitchen, and they really are a joy to use. They feel great when you pick them up. They just have that sense of something that's been crafted really well and deliberately. They cook evenly, they are easy to handle, and they are easy to clean, which is very important as well. So right now, editors, listeners can get 10% off full-priced items from Made In. For full details, visit madeincookware.com/editors. That's M-A-D-E-I-N cookware.com/editors. This truly, these are wonderful products. You will not regret checking it out, and I hope you do. So Noah, terrible tragedy in Gaza. Something like this was inevitable and just such a crowded space with a lot going on. It's just inevitable. Israel is really going to hit the wrong thing. There have already been a lot of tragic civilian casualties, but they hit this aid worker convoy, maybe three vehicles. You probably know the details better than I do, caused even more international outrage. The head of this organization, which is widely respected, World Central Kitchen, has suggested this might have been deliberate. It might have been in response to criticisms that he's made of Bibi Netanyahu, and other aid workers have said, at the very least, Israel has been reckless with regard to routine deconfliction procedures. Apparently, this outfit did and has been providing to Israel its routes where its vehicles are going, and they did in this case as well, but in an awful tragedy, got hit anyway.
Well, we can't get ahead of the investigation. There is an investigation ongoing, but nobody denies that this was a horrific tragedy. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he, quote, deeply regrets the airstrikes that killed these seven aid workers with World Central Kitchen. Israeli Chief of Staff Herzi Halevi said the same, that he was apologizing for the unintentional harm caused here. And as you said, episodes like these occur in wars, terrible as they are and as avoidable as most of them are, because this organization is one of the few international organizations Israel trusts to operate in the Gaza Strip. There are several, but this is one of them. And it strikes me as more than a little opportunistic to see so many of Israel's monomaniacal critics allege that this was a deliberate strike. As you said, celebrity chef Jose Andres, who's the head of this organization, attacked Israel for conducting a war against humanity. He said that this was likely a deliberate attack. The United Nations Special Rapporteur for the, quote, occupied Palestinian territories, Francesca Albanese, alleged this bizarre conspiracy theory. Quote, my assessment is that Israeli forces intentionally killed WCK workers so that their donors would pull out and civilians in Gaza could continue to be starved quietly. That's nothing short of insane. It's completely mad. Usually, conspiracy theorists feel compelled by the virtue of their, you know, the the tribute vice pays to virtue here by establishing something like a plausible quid pro quo to explain why the executors of their plots have something resembling a motive. They don't feel any compunction in this case, or at least not when it comes to Israel. Israel just does bad things because they're evil. That's probably the beginning, middle, and end of the thought process that goes into these allegations. And it's utterly bizarre unless you attribute it to malice, to bigotry. I think there's very little that you can say about the people who have reacted to this as though it was anything other than a horrific tragedy, and say that they are not champing at the bit to find some rationale to force Joe Biden to abandon his support for Israel. Take, for example, Barack Obama's former Deputy National Security Advisor, Ben Rhodes, who used this opportunity, and it is an opportunity for him, to indict the Biden administration for provisioning Israel with 2,000-pound bombs. This is something that Israel's critics have been obsessed with for the duration of this war, saying that they're very big bombs, and they leave big craters, and they're using a lot of them, and they're very dangerous, and it's just utter lack of regard for human life with all the associated damage that they do. And that's just simply not true. These bombs have profound utility. They are designed to penetrate the ground and get at these bunkers, which are deep underground. That actually limits the collateral damage they can do, because when you detonate them at or below ground level, they obviously limit the footprint of the bomb. And it has absolutely nothing at all to do with the weapons that were used in this particular strike, which were precision-guided munitions. And obviously, PGMs are those 2,000-pound bombs, too. But it doesn't matter, because the point is they don't like Israel. They don't want Biden to support Israel's war. They don't want Israel to emerge victorious from this war. They want it to end, and they want it to end tomorrow, which would leave Hamas in place. That's their goal. They're being coy about it, but we shouldn't be. We should say exactly what their objectives are outright. Disasters happen in war. The reason why we should hope that Israel ends this war as speedily and judiciously as possible is so that these disasters end. That is what will put an end to Gaza's suffering, nothing else.
So, MBD, you're not a pacifist, you're not an isolationist, but you have a keen sense of how wars can spiral out of control and create unintended consequences. In other news from the region, Israel struck an Iranian facility, embassy, I guess, in Damascus.
It was a consulate.
Hit an IRGC general or officer who is the most senior officer in Syria, and a couple other Iranian officials. The criticism of this is, well, you know, you need to coordinate this with the U.S. Apparently they didn't, because, you know, there could be consequences for the U.S. And the other is, well, you guys are risking escalating this conflict. What do you make of it?
Well, I don't think it's in Israel's interest to fight a regional war with, you know, four or five, you know, full-on powers acting as full belligerents in the war. I do think Israel believes these strikes are justified as part of its campaign to destroy Hamas and the network of support it relies upon. So I think Israel is walking a very difficult tightrope in this, because Hamas has support from these other regional partners, from parts of states, you know, from parts of the Iranian state apparatus that may, you know, make themselves deliberately ignorant to other parts of the state apparatus in Iran, and same thing in Qatar, who's one of our strategic partners in the region. So I think Israel has done a remarkable job. I actually think even other actors in the region have done a job at restraining themselves from joining a war that I think many radical Sunni Muslims would like to join against Israel. I think Israel is doing a fine job. I think the assault on the humanitarian convoy is a result of, unfortunately, this kind of insane situation where Israel is sovereign, right, is technically sovereign over Gaza, but in a way where it's surrendered, right? It moved all Jews out of there in 2006 and allowed Gaza to govern itself and to elect Hamas. And Hamas is not a reliable partner. So everyone who wants to do humanitarian aid to poor, suffering Palestinians, and there are many poor, suffering Palestinians in this conflict, they have to coordinate with Israel. They don't really have a reliable partner in Hamas. In fact, Hamas is probably gobbling up most of this aid and using it strategically to keep itself in power for as long as possible. So, I mean, this is kind of this insane situation where the world opinion in a totally novel way expects Israel literally to feed the hand that bites them in war. And, you know, the horrors that this war is inflicting on a humanitarian level, I mean, we have to say that it's the result of it being an urban war, it being a war in an urban infrastructure that is poorly built in many cases, poorly built because it's governed by Hamas and resources are taken away from sound engineering and put to the use of creating a tunnel network for terrorists. This devastation almost at every sector, you have to underline that the Hamas's responsibility for it. Israel's job in this war is to win the war, and it's defined winning the war as destroying Hamas. All other goals are secondary, including, you know, the humanitarian effort to help Palestinians. That's a goal that other people can contribute to and share. And I think if you want to argue that there are people lacking in that, look to Egypt, which is doing practically nothing for Palestinians. So, bottom line, I think Israel is doing a very difficult job, very carefully, very sensitively. It is a very ugly job, though. I mean, war like this is terrible, and it compounds the evil act that happened on October 7th, which initiated this conflict.
So I want to shoehorn a little politics into this ep. So I'm going to do it via an exit question or perhaps exit questions. I might double barrel this. So that's a warning to you, Jack Butler, to you first. If Donald Trump came to you, and you know, Jack, there was a controversy 2 weeks ago or so and at an Ohio rally where Trump referred to a coming bloodbath in the auto industry. If we don't get tariffs on Chinese cars coming in from Mexico, this created a huge controversy. Your man, by the way, J.D. Vance, was at this rally and briefly spoke, Jack. And Trump, it looks as though maybe he's going to embrace this term. He had an event at Grand Rapids where he talked about the bloodbath at the border. This was actually on a sign affixed to the podium where he was speaking. So if Mr. Trump came to you, Jack, and said, I asked for your advice, would you say, sir, just let's just avoid that term? You know, it was distorted and no reason to poke the bear. Let's just leave the B word aside. Or would you say, sir, double down. This is another opportunity for you to take something that's been hurled at you by your critics and turn it around and rebrand it and use it for your purposes brilliantly.
Well, this is a amusing hypothetical to contemplate. So what would I say? I think the bloodbath thing, it could be useful for Trump and people who are already bought in on Trump to just dwell on the willful misinterpretation that the media is so fond of doing of him. Beyond that inner circle, though, I'm not really sure it has that power. And to the extent it doesn't have that power, I might suggest to Mr. Trump, sir, that you start looking for other attacks or other campaigns.
That's it. You're fired. Methods. You're fired, Jack.
Well, I did not expect this position to last very long anyway. So, oh well.
All right. So MBD, Jack's very conventional. He says no bloodbath talk. What do you think?
Honestly, I'll just confess. I find applying the word bloodbath indiscriminately in other subjects to be repulsive personally. And I'm obviously a conservative.
Meaning like using it metaphorically, like even about the car industry? Or
no, it's fine. The first instance of it was fine. Mm-hmm. But then just being like, ooh, the word excited controversy, and now I'm going to apply it in subjects like the border, where it's, you know, it's, you're no longer using it as like a financial metaphor, you know, kind of a financial cliche when he used it the first time.
Yeah.
Now you're using it in these other contexts. I find it repulsive. However, I'll just say I'm not the average voter, and Trump has a genius for these things.
Repulsive is a strong word.
And how?
Welcome to Team Squish.
I'm saying I find it repulsive, but Trump is such a genius for these controversies, and he has a way of, you know, road testing these words to see if they generate positive press or controversy, and he thinks he benefits from the controversy, and usually he does, I think, because the media oversteps. And so I would say, like, Mr. President, I worry about what this is doing to you in the suburbs, but, you know, let's see how it works the next couple weeks.
And very judicious.
He's probably not fired. He's probably.
It's serious. That's seriously what I would say. Because I have to surrender the fact that, you know, I am not the average voter.
You
know, there are other voters like me, but
I'll jump in and say my answer. Then we'll get to know, because it's basically what you're saying. I don't find it repulsive. I find it, you know, it's an opposite. It's not the word for what's happening at the border. But I just have a sense of self doubt, because there's so many of these other things. I say, oh, don't say that, you know. And sometimes you really shouldn't say them, but also sometimes it totally works out for him. I don't see how this really helps. So I would, in a very hedged manner, not like Jack, I wouldn't be as forthright as Jack and just get fired and, you know, hustled out by security the way Jack would. But I would say probably not great to do this, but with some doubt. Noah.
Well, as a matter of politics, I don't think it matters all that much. I think this really enlivens Donald Trump's core base, and it really inflames the resistance left. And they love to argue about, you know, the meaning and really perform an interrogation of the context of this sort of thing. I don't think, as Michael said, I don't think voters evaluate it that way. I will say I take a bit of perverse pleasure in Donald Trump sawing the limb out from behind the people who climb out under it so routinely. So when he used this phrase in its metaphorical context, and it was taken out of context to say that, you know, he actually meant it literally, that there will be blood in the streets if he loses the election. A lot of Trump supporters came out in front of that and said, ah, you guys are being crazy. He meant it as a metaphor. And now he's using it absolutely literally, saying that the bloodbath at the border, actually it does mean a bloodbath. There is people who are losing their lives as a result of migrant crime, quote unquote, which is what he's trying to emphasize here on the website where he's using this language. So I do kind of enjoy yet another
But he's not saying there's going to be rioting in the street if I'm not elected.
That's what he wasn't saying last week, Rich, or 2 weeks ago. But I wouldn't put myself in a position of saying he'll never, ever say that.
Yeah, but he wasn't saying
that. All but guarantees he has to.
What he was saying about the border was not that.
It's like Chekhov's gun. If you say he didn't actually say that, he will at some point say it and mean it.
Right. So, Jack, double barrel quickly here, because we've got to move on. So the Wall Street Journal did extensive and seemingly very credible swing state polling. I think in 7 swing states, Trump was leading in 6 of the 7, maybe not leading in Wisconsin. No, is a polling maven, so he can correct me. And I think that was in the head-to-head in the three-way or five-way, whatever it is. I think Trump maybe was leading in all of them. Not huge leads, you know, very narrow leads. But Jack, the extra question to you is, did this change, this bout of polling, change at all your view of the likelihood that Donald Trump will win in November, if even by, you know, a percentage point or half percentage point, your consideration of the chances that Trump will win?
No, I'm about where I was before, because this poll is similar to a lot of polls that we've seen. And I'm in a weird position of looking at all of these polls and fighting it hard to ignore them, but also in the back of my mind wondering if they will change or if there's something amiss about them. And I know that's a bad place for Trump.
We haven't had you pronounce on your percentage odds.
No, you haven't. And I've been.
What is it? Let me guess what it is. you're a 45% guy, Jack. That's what I think.
45% what?
That Trump will win.
Yeah, I think that's about where I am. I'll let you go. You have me well. Figured out. Why do you even? you could have my answers.
Change you at all?
No, it's a coin flip.
No change. It was Wisconsin where that they were tied in a head to head in that series of swing state polls. And if you introduce, you know, five ways, three ways, what have you, Trump does a little bit better. But the state of play is the state of play. It hasn't necessarily changed. Indeed, Franklin Marshall is a Pennsylvania-based pollster with a piece out today. A poll out today shows Pennsylvania in the Biden camp outside the margin of error. So you can choose your own adventure. One of the things that I think Trump and company shouldn't sleep on is that these polls that show him ahead show him at, very consistently, 46, 47, 48, 49 in North Carolina's case, if you even believe that's a swing state. I don't necessarily do. But that's exactly where I expect him to be. I expect him to get 47, 48% of the vote in these states and nationally. I don't expect Joe Biden to get 42, 43, 44, which is where he's at now.
So it doesn't change me either. I'm still 52%. It just confirms Trump, I believe, is ahead a little bit here. You know, the caveat support, things could change. Obviously, it's still early, obviously. And then the numbers that are just being picked up, and this very much included this Wall Street Journal set of polls, are just so astonishing when it comes to young people, Black voters, and Latino voters, that you kind of want to see it happen in November to totally believe it. But
30% of Black men,
yeah,
voting 30%. For Donald Trump.
Yeah, and being in a position of underestimating Trump at the polls is not a great... I mean, historically, it makes me nervous to be in that place given things that have happened in the recent past. All right. So
let me... I have big news for our listeners. This is big, guys. Finally, what you've all been waiting for, a listener survey is now running. You can go to nationalreview.com/survey. Very intuitive, right? nationalreview.com/survey. And you can tell us all about what you like about our podcast, what you dislike about our podcast, what you enjoy, what you hate, what you want to suggest, which will be very helpful to us as we craft our programming to meet your desires. We want to serve our listeners within limits. So, Jack, we had a statement from Richard Dawkins on this British show. Richard Dawkins is the sociobiologist. I believe he wrote The Selfish Gene, right? Is that him, or am I mixing him up with someone else? And he was part of this in the, you know, 05, 06, 07 period. There was this rise of these militant atheists, very much including Richard Dawkins, also including the late Christopher Hitchens. And this apparently isn't anything new for Dawkins to say, but it was notable on this interview. He's described himself as a cultural Christian before, but in this interview, he was asked about, apparently in London over the Holy Week, they had Ramadan stuff up, but no nothing marking this high holy day on the Christian calendar. And Dawkins says he was taken aback by that he loves churches, he loves hymns, he loves Christmas songs. He would really regret if all the great cathedrals and parish churches in Britain disappeared, and then expressed dismay at the rise of Islam, which he considers Christianity a fundamentally decent religion, as I believe he put it, and Islam not. What do you make of it?
What do I make of it? Well, I told you so. Is that an option? So Dawkins is an interesting case. He's been in recent years, this actually happened with a lot of these new atheist types who are now what you would classify them. And are we still talking about the intellectual dark web, those sort of heterodox former liberals.
The last time I heard you say it, heard someone say it was also you.
Oh, well, so he's one of these people who's, he's not willing to go all the way leftward where the left is now. So, but I'm still going to pick on him because he's been very publicly anti-Christianity in his public life. And now he is like, wow, maybe this was good to have this Christian culture. Could we keep this around somehow? I think even in the same interview, he said that he was glad that fewer people are going to church, but he would be sad if, you know, if the cathedrals closed and whatnot. And it's a package deal, buddy. Someone's got to go to church. You can't all be, you can't just be have a nation of religious free riders in this sense. So that these things go together. And to the extent that he's contributed to the very situation he is now declaiming, it's a bit of a, it's a real temptation, to use a religious term, to mock him, but it's a serious problem. And there are people within the conservative firmament who are probably generating earthquakes measurable on the Richter scale upon seeing his remarks. People like Frank Meyer, Whitaker Chambers, Orestes Bronson, or on his side of the Atlantic, Edmund Burke. But I've been
the first Orestes Bronson reference on this podcast ever. Yeah. Finally, I don't know. Yeah. Sarah will have to tell me what episode we are, but you know.
Yeah, we were waiting. There are people who were waiting with bated breath. But I was also thinking of this.
Great guy, incredible writer.
Yeah, I was just reading that he's top of mind. I was just reading some of his works. So, but I was also thinking of this in terms, since you mentioned the early 2000s and the original period where he became controversial about this stuff, there were two items of popular culture around the same time that were produced. And I was thinking which of them was more prophetic. So on the one hand, you have this ridiculous movie, V for Vendetta, where you know, a right-wing Christian fascist government has taken power in the United Kingdom. And one character who's kind of like a Richard Dawkins type has secretly squirreled away a Quran. Also, he's gay. So interesting set of attributes there. On the other hand, you have something like Children of Men, where you have a post-religious England, which is also fascist, but seems to be just totally hopeless and it just desperate for meaning. No children. That's the most important part. Children aren't being born. So it's severed from its posterity and from its antecedents. Which of these documents seems like a more accurate depiction of where that country and where the West was going and where it has come? And the book, by the way, makes it much clearer that religion has just totally vanished from the England of that of the future and Children of Men.
So I was one of my first dates with my wife was going to be to go see V is for Vendetta. But as we left the cab in the Upper West Side and went to this enormous theater on Broadway in Manhattan, I realized I'd left my wallet in the cab. So
that was providential.
Yeah, so I had to cancel everything, and this is the first. My wife should have taken this as a sign that my efficacy at real life things maybe wasn't so great.
And all this is amazing. This
happened to me, I think, twice when I lived in New York, where I lost wallets, and eventually they show, you know, like the post office sends them to you. It's so like, you know, 3 months later, my wallet showed up in the mail. But anyway, MBD. So Dawkins, you know, he's very comfortable with this contradiction because in this very interview, he said the number of Christians are declining, and that's a good thing. But you know, I appreciate all these attributes of it. So to Jack's point, devil's advocate point for me here, why can't you have a free-riding society? Don't we have a lot of free-riding societies in Western Europe now? Isn't Britain fundamentally a free-riding society where it still has all these beautiful churches and cathedrals, right? The cathedrals, at least, aren't going to be bulldozed. And you have a society that was profoundly formed by Christianity, but it's you know, the number of believers is steadily declining. But why can't Richard Dawkins have his cake and eat it too?
Well, he probably can. I mean, for a few more years left in his life, he's an older man. But the reason, you know, we as an abstraction can't have it is pretty simple. Like, it's demographics, my friend, and that's what he's confronting now. Right? Is that there is a religious minority in the UK that is Islamic, that is insurgent in its kind of view of itself in Europe, that is self-confident, that is ambitious, even I would say streetwise in many ways, that Christianity seems not to be in Europe. And it's getting its way, right? Like, it's getting its way in a blasphemy law in Scotland. It's getting its way in these Ramadan acknowledgments from the state and city that aren't given to Christians anymore. Right? Like, you know, if you, the future is for who shows up in it. And if Christians don't have children, and if Christians don't make converts, there won't be Christians, there won't be churches, right? I mean, like, and all these little things are dying. I mean, this week it was reported that because of a secular campaigner in Ireland, Dublin Airport will no longer allow priests to bless planes like they used to. And they used to name the planes after saints there too. So all these things can go away, like, and I think what Dawkins and others are confronting is a truth that confronted the historian Tom Holland, which is, okay, I like that, you know, the kind of husk of Christendom that I live in has values of mercy, of, you know, that appreciates victims and tries to be solicitous towards them, that admires long suffering. I like this society. And now I have to come to the grips that that society was produced by Christian liturgy and theology soaking into the society and its institutions for nearly 2,000 years. And that when those, when that theology and that liturgy disappears and the adherence to it disappear, something else is going to come in and it won't be the same. And in fact, it could be profoundly different. And I think people feel it sharply now that the, there are threats like either Islamism on one side or a kind of Chinese Communist Party-led tech social credit dystopia on the other. And they're looking, you know, suddenly Christianity suddenly looks like, you know, it offers a Prince of Peace and something gentle and mild in comparison.
Yeah.
Well, I confess to be a little conflicted over the conversation, in part because I think we should probably not conflate what Dawkins is complaining about here, which is the decline of one theology to be replaced with another, competing theology, in this case, Islamism, which is something to be profoundly concerned about. But as Michael said, you know, there's a distinction to be made between that and competing theologies and what you describe, Michael, as the Chinese Marxian vision, which is atheism or anti-theism, which is itself a theism,
yeah,
or at least something resembling a set of theological beliefs, even though it is hostile to theology broadly, which is not the same thing as secularism or even irreligiosity. There's a piece in Unheard by Esme Partridge, who helpfully identified that Dawkins has had this view since 2007, calls himself a cultural Christian, although is a non-believer and an evangelist for non-belief. But she writes, without public religion, anarchic systems of self-interest, which undermine the virtues upon which liberalism was originally premised, will flourish. And the assumption there is that without public religion, the United States becomes a fundamentally indecent society. And I just reject that kind of eschatological outlook, which is, again, a religious outlook. Because I find it a little solipsistic. It's just informed by my own experience, admittedly. But also, because I'm raised secular. My dad's Jewish. My mom's Catholic. I wasn't accepted by either. So just kind of had to feel my way around. And theology has been an academic pursuit for me for the most part. But that doesn't mean I'm not communitarian. I'm deeply invested in my community and believe communitarianism to be a fundamental pillar of being a fully fledged person, not just your civic obligation, but ultimately your psychological health will be significantly impaired if you're, you know, succumb to an enemy. But the rise of the nons in the United States, 3 out of 10 Americans don't identify with religion. And yet the United States is the most generous society on earth, has been for most of this century and for the competing century, previous centuries rather. And social cohesion in the United States is far more robust than it is in the industrialized world. And is that a function purely of religious attendance, at services? There's a piece in The Atlantic that's getting a lot of attention by Derek Thompson this week about, quote, the social collapse is steepest for some of the groups with the largest declines in religiosity. And I believe that because they're not replacing it with something resembling a community spirit. They're succumbing to, as we talked about in the hate segment, to phones, to a digital life, which is a facsimile of real life. And I do think there's a certain amount of social obligation that is imposed on you by church attendance, but I don't by any means think that is the only avenue by which an individual can find that sort of fulfillment and connection to the community, and therefore the obligations that come with it, which is all a part of being a fully fledged adult. So I am conflicted on this one. But I don't necessarily think that Dawkins' advocacy here for sort of the trappings of Christianity is wholly flawed. I do think that that imparts a certain cultural competency and the series of obligations associated with it, even if you're not finding yourself in the pews every Sunday.
So, Jack, next question to you. You have much more respect for a so-called Christian atheist like Richard Dawkins than an atheist. Yes or no?
I would say more. I don't know if it's much more. And I would almost, there's a sense in which the fact that someone like him realizes the social utility makes me more critical. Because then I'm wondering, like, so what do you think? Do you think you can just have, where do you think the social utility comes from? It comes from people actually believing in it. So I guess I'm of two minds. Am I allowed to be of two minds when answering exit questions?
No, but we'll let pass this time. MBD.
I appreciate Dawkins more than the pure scoffer in that I think at least he's showing a humane sensitivity toward where our values come from historically. And I think, I also think that just the more fertile ground for the seed of real belief is in cultural Christianity and in people who do feel something when they hear a hymn around Christmas or hear the bells rung on Sunday morning and, you know, feel at least some tug on their heart. I think that's obviously, you know, the more fertile soil for something richer to grow in.
No.
The Dawkins view as opposed to the pure atheist, in part because the Judeo-Christian foundations of the societies in the West that we've, you know, been bequeathed and inherited blessedly. The kind of rejection of that can be a species of self-hatred. And that's probably an indicator of deeper psychological malady and a deeper psychological desire to reject the self and your society and everything around you than necessarily a real, like, deep theological commitment to atheism.
I agree with that. I have more respect for the Christian atheist than the atheist. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. MBD, you are fond of a local theater called the movie theater called The Prospector.
Yeah, the last week I said I was anticipating going to see Godzilla X Kong with my son. It turns out both my sons came. They enjoyed it very much. I enjoyed just the theater. There's a theater in Ridgefield, Connecticut called The Prospector. It's a very special institution. First of all, it's a beautiful building in the heart of this really idyllic New England town. But it makes a point of employing almost 90% of its employees are people with disabilities, Down syndrome and the like. And it creates a theater going atmosphere that's really positive. It makes me feel really good about being overcharged for soda and popcorn. And you know, it provides employment and jobs for people who are otherwise overlooked in the employment market. They get to associate themselves with Hollywood, which is a little glamorous in itself. And they make popcorn that can be shipped off. They make specialized popcorn that can be shipped all over the country. I think at prospectorpopcorn.org. And I just think it's a beautiful institution. And I wish more affluent communities had institutions like this, which are inventive and serve a really important mission for an overlooked group.
Awesome. Jack, you've been taken with folklore about the Great Lakes.
Yes, I consider myself a connoisseur of folklore. You guys were talking a couple weeks ago about what you would do, or was it last week? I already can't remember, about what you would do if you were forced not to do your current job. I would wander the country investigating local myths and legends and just savoring them, especially about the Great Lakes region where I'm from. I'm reading a great book right now, dipping in and out of it, called Haunted Lake Michigan. And I just love this stuff. The ghost ships, the people who linger on dunes in spirit form, the legends of creatures under the water. I could read about this stuff for the rest of my life and I would be endlessly fascinated by it. So it's great.
Noah, you saw the second Dune movie.
I did. So I was never really deeply into the series, although I did try to read the books as a young man, and I don't think I succeeded. I have a vague recollection of it. I also had my very first CD-ROM game on the computer was a strategy game based on Dune. So I have some affection for it in my heart. But the first one did nothing for me. My wife loved it. So I took her to see it in the theaters, and I realized why it did nothing for me is because I missed the whole point of the movie, which is the sound design. The sound design is unbelievable, even in just a regular old theater, not like an IMAX or anything. What they did with the beat of it, like the throbbing tempo of it, and the bass was just a physical experience. And it was really something that actually did hold your attention, most of my attention. I've become a narcoleptic in my old age when it comes to movie theaters. So I did fall asleep twice. But I was woken up very promptly by the incredible sound design. So kudos to the filmmakers.
So I met a Titans fan in Manhattan last night. I am a Tennessee Titans fan who's not anywhere near Tennessee. So I take great delight when I see anyone with any Titan paraphernalia. It doesn't happen very often, maybe, I don't know, once a year or maybe more, but I always talk to whoever I see. So this kid was on the sidewalk. Hey, I was like, hey, you're a Titans fan? He's like, yeah, sort of. My cousin plays for them. I was like, well, really? What's his name? Will Levis. So I met Will Levis's cousin last night, and this was shortly before Manhattan succumbed to near typhoon conditions. There are very few times in Manhattan where I just haven't been able to like walk outside because of the rain and wind. But anyway, I took some delight in my near brush with Will Levis. I'm going to say I almost met Will Levis. So with that, it's time for our editor's picks. MBD, what's your pick?
My pick this week is couple pieces by Caroline Downey. I'm just going to group together. She's just been following up on some college beats about wokeness and University of Texas and UCLA. And it's something that's been on my mind this week about colleges and the kind of undermining of their own mission that they're doing and engaged in. And she's the one getting the details day by day for the site, along with a lot of others. So check her out.
Yeah, Butler, what's your pick?
My pick is Mitch Daniels, How George Will Changed My Mind. This is a tribute by Mitch Daniels to the writing of George Will. And I thought
this was never going to get to you, Jack, by the way.
Oh, it came, and it was a glorious arrival. I just have to say, as someone who read George Will, his column syndicated in my hometown paper, and who probably when I was first becoming aware of politics in the 2010 or so, admired Mitch Daniels more than any other political figure. I had the privilege of sort of shepherding this into existence. And this was my high school self, my very weird high school self would have been thrilled to know that I got this experience.
Your high school self is still there, Jack. Don't
yourself. Well, he's weird, but he's out of high school, thankfully.
Noah.
I'm glad Jack put in a good word for the Mitch Daniels piece. I would have otherwise, but that was never going to be my pick. My pick is yours, Rich. Yes, fight anti-white racism. Very provocative topic. Comes as the Trump administration has said that they will emphasize this. And it is a excellent trap to lay for the progressive left, who hears we should fight anti-white racism, and they hear we should promote pro-white racism, which is illustrative of their confusion on the subject. When it comes to their woke revisionism, they're at war with the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause. The Biden administration has run afoul of it on a couple of occasions by trying to provide special dispensation, taxpayer-funded dispensation, to American minorities, which violates the Equal Protection Clause. And they keep doing it. And it turns out, by the way, that Americans actually like the Equal Protection Clause, and it puts them on the puts progressives on the wrong side of public opinion. A good piece and an interesting strategy for the Trump
campaign. Thanks, Noah. So my pick is a book review in the print magazine, which harkens back to our first topic this episode. It's by Naomi Riley, who's long been on this beat herself. It's a dual review of Abigail Schreier's new book about therapy, and the hate book, and a review titled How We Ruined Childhood. So that's it for us. You've been listening to a National U podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National U Magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schitte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Noah. Thank you, MBD. Thank you, Jackie B. Thanks to Made In. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.